Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
The game of football has always been associated with team sport, but also some personal accolades. Today, Timothy B. Brown of Football Archaeology takes us on a route of the history of handing out the game ball. Tim's coming up in a moment to tell us all about it.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal for positive football history. And it is Tuesday, and football archaeology is on my mind. And we have the founder of that great website, Timothy P. Brown, with us. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren. This should be an awarding podcast to participate in.
An awarding podcast. You're segueing into our subject, I think, and we're going to find out a little bit more of that. Your title of your tidbit that you had just a few months ago, or maybe a few weeks ago, is A History of Game Balls. And
yes,
you know, pretty broad topic, but it sounds like you have some direction for us on that.
Yeah, well, so I took a very narrow view in this case of game balls, you know, more in terms of the awarding of the game ball, you know, the game ball being, you know, trophy value, you know, kind of a game ball. But, you know, I kind of started that article talking about, you know, for an NFL game, at least nowadays, there are 36 balls prepared to be part of the game. So 12 submitted from each team. And then I think each team also submits 6 kicking balls, right? And so, the kicking balls come directly from Wilson. Because the league, you know, too many people are manipulating the kicking balls. And so they get those directly from the league. The teams do get a chance to like massage them and whatever beforehand.
And if Tom Brady's playing, then 4 of them have to be at 8 pounds.
That's right. Well, so, you know, the Inflategate thing is a whole other story. But the game ball, one of the coolest things about, I published that article on March 29th. And since then, I have uncovered a whole other slew of information that tells me that I was wrong, or at least, you know, that I didn't find as early information as I thought I had. So at the time I was, you know, saying, look, you know, the game balls, you know, that whole awarding of game balls at the time that I wrote it, as far as I could trace it back to, is like 1886, when, you know, it was mentioned in an article about a Princeton commencement, you know, ceremony. And they were mentioning that the game ball from the game that they had played when they had beaten Yale was on the rostrum or whatever, you know, for commencement. So it kind of tells you how important, you know, when the football game was to those guys. But because of another path of research that I'm doing, I was trying to dig into, you know, what all is, you know, what all is going on, or, you know, kind of the background of game balls. And part of it was that, you know, for a long time, like from when American football began, and, you know, to my liking, it began in 1876 with the IFA. You know, the funding in the IFA, when American football first got started, they only used one ball per game. You know, that was it. You know, rain, shine, snow, sleet, whatever. They played with one ball, and those balls weren't anywhere near as, the leather wasn't as well protected, et cetera, as they are now. So, these balls get waterlogged. And in the days of drop kicking, you drop it on the ground and the thing would barely bounce off, So, but then as the forward pass came in, into favor, then in 1917, they allowed the referee to decide on a wet day if he would allow a second ball to be used for the second half. And then eventually, things spread. But, so there was this whole thing of you played with one ball. And so then this whole tradition developed around awarding or presenting the game ball to the victor. So, back in the day, the home team provided the ball, and then if they lost, the right thing to do was to award the ball to the visiting victorious team for them to then go back and paint the score on it or whatever, put it in the trophy case, whatever they were going to do with it. And so that was the tradition, for some time. And so then, since then I found out a couple of new things. So one was that I, recently acquired a copy of a book called The Gilbert Story, which is a story of the Gilbert firm, which is one of the two main cobblers and rugby ball makers in Rugby, England, where the rugby school was. And they're still the primary provider of rugby football, rugby balls for like the World Cup and those kinds of things. So anyways, I got a copy of their ball, and it goes back through the history. And they talk about at the rugby school, there was a tradition of having two balls available for each game, and they got switched at half. But then I got a hold of Tony Collins, who, has been on this podcast. And if anybody hasn't heard that one, that is, a fabulous podcast to listen to because of Tony. But in any event, and he basically confirmed that, that rugby never really had the tradition of multiple game balls. So it was a rugby school thing, but it didn't spread to rugby more generally. They didn't really have a one ball or two balls, or they didn't really have a standard. So somehow in the Americas, this one ball tradition came about. And then it turns out that an earlier awarding of a game ball came about when, I think most people are aware that Harvard played McGill in 1874 in a rugby match, and that is really what led to Harvard playing rugby, and which is le what led to American football developing from rugby. Well, in 1875, maybe the second, and 1876, there was an All-Canada team that played three games against Harvard, and in one of those games, All-Canada, they lost all three. All-Canada lost all three to Harvard. In at least one of those games, they awarded the ball to Harvard. So that then becomes, at least best as I can tell so far, the first awarding of a game ball in at least the football tradition. But the fun thing about that is that, there just weren't a lot of rugby balls hanging around in the US because people weren't playing it. But, they were starting to make that transition. So, the IFA meets in November 1876, and they agree to play rugby instead of, whatever soccer and other games that they were playing. And so the weekend after that meeting, Princeton was the home team for a game against Yale, and but they didn't have a rugby ball, and yet they were supposed to play under rugby rules. So somewhere in that whole process, Harvard gave Princeton this ball that all Canada had given them. And then Princeton loses, so they give the ball to Yale. And that ball now sits in a trophy case at Yale in their gymnasium. So, it's just kind of cool that it's literally probably the first game played under the IFA rules, IFA rugby rules. So in my mind, it's the first real football game. And yet that ball is still around, sitting in a trophy case at Yale, because it was the game ball. So I just think it's just kind of a cool, kind of the way this whole story ends up, that the game ball tradition preceded American football, because the Canadians are the ones that, gave it to the, started it, as far as we're concerned. And yet that first ball is still around, sitting in a trophy case at Yale. I just think that's, for me, there's something magical about that.
You know, now that you say that, you make a tour of that I took of Yale probably about 10 years ago makes some sense, because I had the opportunity to with my wife's cousin was an assistant coach at Yale, and I got to tour the Yale Bowl and the locker rooms and just see all the tradition and the Walter Camp sort of. I guess not really. That's a monument, I guess. That's what looks more like a facade to the White House, front of the White House. But I got to see that. But we also got to go through the gymnasium you're talking about with all the halls of trophy, and it's a very great place. And there was one ball that really stood out that just didn't look like a football at all, and very tattered, old, and you could tell. And I wish I would have took a photograph of it, because that's probably that ball that you're talking about.
So I mean, let me describe the ball to you. I've not seen it myself, but I've seen images of it. So it is a classic melon ball. I mean, it is almost round, and there's a big silver plaque embedded into the ball now, with that basically tells the story of, hey, this is awarded by the All Canada team. We gave, it went from Harvard to Princeton, Princeton to Yale, and now it sits here. So it's there's a, I think the I think I put the link in, I've added a postscript to this story, on the website. And I think I have a link to it, because I found it on a site called, is it College Antiques? But anyway, so there's another guy kind of went through this whole thing, which is where I kind of picked up on this story, and then I found other stuff on it. But anyways,
Yeah.
it's just
Yeah.
a cool story, and to my knowledge, the oldest existing ball in American football.
Yeah, I mean that's a awesome story, and I didn't realize it went back that far of exchanging that game ball. Now, wasn't there a sort of a t in that era and all the way up into the maybe early 20th century where teams didn't have but one ball? Because I can recollect there's a story, I think, of the big game, Stanford and Cal, like a 1901 or 1902 game, where they forgot to bring that one ball to the game. The home team, the visiting team didn't even bring a game ball. It was only the home team had that one game ball.
And I don't remember the specifics, but I do remember the story. And I think you're right about, Cal Stanford. And so it was one of those things where, like, they sent people into town to go get one, and
Right.
they couldn't find one. And the same thing happened with when McGill visited Harvard in 1874. They didn't bring a rugby ball. I guess they thought, Harvard would have one, but they didn't. Harvard just had a round ball, so they played the first game under Boston rules, and which is somewhat rugby-ish because you could carry the ball, and then they played the second game under rugby rules, but they used a round ball. So, yeah, and there's a whole other thread that I'm working on about there was a thing called the American ball, which, best as I can tell, is actually developed by Charles Goodyear. He did, probably built created the first one, because he created vulcanized rubber. It was like a canvas ball that was kind of covered with vulcanized rubber, canvas ball that was inflated. I don't think it had a separate bladder, but so a lot of the round balls that people used in America in the 1860s and 70s were these American balls. So it may be even that the Harvard Princeton, or that Harvard McGill game, they could have played with an American ball, Or, and then also even like the Princeton Rutgers game, or games in 1869, those were played with a round ball. It could have been an American ball. And that's what everybody called it, the American ball, as compared to an association or a soccer ball or a rugby ball.
No, that ball that Charles Goodyear invented, was it the color of a bit black?
I've seen descriptions of it being red and then
Okay.
and also black. So
Because I sit there and I know I have an old book on Walter Camp, and it starts off as him as a boy playing. You know, he had a black rubber ball that he just kicked around the yard and, kicked over his mother's clothesline into the clothes and everything, and that's how he, trained for to get become a football player eventually. And I wonder if maybe that was one of those Charles Goodyear balls, because that would have been right around the time frame. I think vulcanized rubber was in the late 1830s, so probably
I think
1840s or 50s
Goodyear
is probably the
and
ball.
his stuff, maybe a little bit later than that, but anyways. Yeah,
Yeah.
I think so. Basically, if it was leather covered, it is probably, an association sort of ball. But even their balls were like, it wasn't real, they didn't agree on a certain ball until 1872. So, things are kind of, it's kind of whatever you could get your hands on, frankly, back in the day. And they had all kinds of different sizes. I mean, rugby, American, and association balls all came in like multiple sizes, in like 3-inch increments. And so, like, size number 5 had a 27-inch circumference. And so, if you think about one of the most popular balls in American football has been the J5V, or and preceding that was the J5. Well, that J was the model. The Spalding model was a J, and before that, it was a lily white rugby ball from England called a J. And the number 5 was the 27-inch circumference. So that J5 name goes all the way back to the beginning.
Okay, as soon as you said the number 5, I was going to ask you if it corresponded to the J5, so I'm glad you cleared that up. Yeah.
It's so the letter was the model and the number was the size, because they were selling size 2, size 3, size 4, 5, and 6. So like a 33-inch ball, 30 and 33-inch balls were, whatever.
Yeah, I know they don't do it with footballs anymore, the size, and now it's like junior and whatever, pro and whatever, yeah, NFHS. But soccer balls still have their sizes on them. I know you have, like, my daughter, when she was playing, used a 4, and then I think the pros in high school and college used a number 5. So
Well,
must
and
be
that so
cool.
it's the same it's the same sequencing. And
Yeah.
they're still junior footballs, because my kids played with them, but I don't remember it being a number based system for identifying them. I think they just called it a junior, but whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe they still use a numbering system.
Yeah, I have a junior ball right here, and I don't see a number on it. I have a Wilson TD, and I don't see a number on it. So it's just a Wilson TD Junior. Oh.
So I mean, it's just one of those cool things about the old balls that, here's something that carried on from literally from the beginning that we see every day and never think about, oh, why'd they call it a J5? Well, that's why,
Yeah, fascinating. Great stuff. Now, Tim, you have great stuff like this, a lot on your website and your posts. And maybe you could introduce the listeners who haven't heard or read you before to how they can take part in what you're writing.
Best thing to do is just go to footballarchaeology.com and find the site, just subscribe. You can subscribe for free. You can There's a paid version as well. You can also follow me on Twitter and on Threads and on the Substack app. So, you can find me on any of those four methods, or just go out and search the site whenever you want to.
Great stuff as always. We really appreciate it, and it's really enlightening about the ball, and some of the history of it. And we really thank you for that. And love to talk to you again next week about some more great football history.
Very good. Look forward to it. Thanks.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's 4th and long. We're gonna have to punt the ball and get on out of here. But we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines. So be sure to tune in. we invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. PigskinDispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans, this is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that, Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.